Mr. Boyne, Reel 10. We were talking about, well, we've got to the point on the night of the 18th when you'd lagered, probably back at Ranville, that's what the thing says, but you'd lagered anyway. Before you had a chance to sort of collapse asleep, you mentioned refuelling and ammunition had already been a problem once. Would that all have to be done before you could go to sleep?
Oh, yeah. Mm. As soon as the... as soon as you lagered, the come up, and they'd run down the lines with ammunition. You'd tell them what ammunition you wanted, and they'd offload it. Rations and petrol, of course. Now, sometimes they were nice and early, and I think on one time they were something like 3 hours late as they couldn't get through. So, what do you do? I mean, you catnap or whatever. But I think there they were up fairly quickly. We reloaded with the ammunition, refueled. I think then more time was spent trying to sort of locate your friends. But it was only after all that was done then could you then settle down. But again, there was still a guard to be put on. There was still a radio watch to be done. So the chances are that you might get one or the other, and that would be in the 2 or 3 hours that you've got left to yourself sometime. So you were running down because of these demands. You were getting extremely tired, I'm sure. And I say, I think that night, I don't think we bothered to put a baby out. We just sort of sat there where we were.
Would new tanks come up?
They did. They came up. In, there was a few came up in the morning and rejoined us. But I don't think there were particularly many.
And would the crews who'd had to, you know, who'd lost the tanks, those who were fat capable, there wouldn't be new crews come up, or were there?
They were initially there, because a lot of those they'd walk back and there would be an echelon. Whether they were pumped into the new crews or not, I couldn't tell. Those that were fit, yeah, probably would, but they'd be the ones to sort of tell you that, I'm sure.
Now, another thing is, there was a heavy German bombing raid that night
on the echelon.
Do you remember that?
Only the planes, the noise of the planes, but no, I can't tell you much about that at all. But you looked at some of the echelon,
Now, the next thing is the... on the 19th, there doesn't seem to be that much in... You were in reserve during the morning. And it's around about this time that the Major Powell was killed. And I believe Joe Powell. I believe you saw that. If you could take us through what happened that morning.
I think the morning would be more as a slow start up to the start line. We didn't move. Was shooting with particularly far, but we formed up on a field again with the hedge of the country, the Bocage start of hedge, and we were getting stomped by these Nebel Werfers out there. And they didn't alarm us particularly much, but for infantry or anybody out on foot, they were pretty horrendous. They were coming over in droves. As I think I said before, they're like little dustbins coming over. You could see them in the air, in the flight. But I can remember seeing Major Powell and another coming along the hedge in front. His tank was just behind us, and they came along the hedge, trotting as it were, and they parted, and he turned to face my vehicle, and he started running. His trot got into a run, and he was bending. He was getting lower and lower, his body. He was almost folded in half when he virtually ran out of my sight. He ran right alongside our vehicle, and this cluster of noble birds landed aside of us, at the back of us, in the front of us, and it's only a couple of minutes after, the dust was still in the air. You get smothered in dust and dirt, and a radio called up for him, for the squadron leader. And the answer was, "I'm sorry, but the squadron leader is not available." And that was it. He caught the one that was almost alongside me. He could have known it, but he heard it coming. I'm sure.
Now, what happened the rest of that day? There was an attack on Hubert Folly, village name, at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, or early evening. Do you remember anything of that? So, what's the next thing you remember? What's the next thing you remember? Because then they moved into Lager, and then they went up to Arden Abbey, which I know you remember. That was around about the 22nd of July.
That was held up there while we re-equipped and brought up new crews, new vehicles. We were parked up alongside this wall of the Arden Abbey. It's strange, isn't it?
Do you remember much about it?
It was, if anything, it was lovely and peaceful. If anything, it was really peaceful. Once you'd done the cleaning up, cleaned the guns, sorted yourselves out, then you had time to sort of sit and have a cup of tea and have a little look round. I didn't know it was an abbey at the time, that's for sure. But I remember walking round the wall of it, seeing this little Volkswagen that had been parked, it had been hit. But that was the only one of the amphibious one I ever saw. But obviously the Germans had used it prior to us being there. It was peace and quiet for a couple of days.
Did you see much of the civilians?
Not a lot. No, not a lot. In the areas where you moved up for, there was an awful lot of cattle dead, of course, and you had the smell of the death of that hanging in the air. But when you pulled back to places like that, it was quite pleasant, very pleasant.
There was a lot of reorganisation going on there. Was that where you changed crew again?
Yeah, I did. I think I came under the lieutenant then.
Do you remember which one?
Do you remember
any of the names of that crew?
No.
And was it a Sherman or a Firefly? No. Still Sherman, right? So what's the next thing you remember after that? You were there for a couple of days, and then they moved up and attack Colmont, or the Colmont area on the Veer Road, things like that.
I remember the Veer Road cutting that. There was, we went up there to actually cut that road, and I can remember we actually got there. There was nothing on that particular road at the time, and we'd actually fired a couple of shots to get the exact range of the road. And I've got an idea. I was the gunner there on that one, for some strange reason. And we fired a couple of shots to just check the range, and then a small convoy of German trucks came down, and we hit them. And again, there were some troops with them, but I think they were mostly carrying whatever it was, it burnt. and the impact of them being hit pushed them off the road virtually, but they got smoke and fire. But the Germans that came out, the trucks, came to leave just and gave themselves up. But one of them was very badly injured, and they came down towards us, and the one that was injured, he was laid out at the side of this hedge that we were laying by, and we stayed there all night, if I remember. But this guy that was wounded was crying for mama. He could. That's all he did, really, intervals. And it was quite harrowing. He was literally dying while at your feet. But that's the only word he was saying was mama. And I thought that if you do have the thought process, but I was thinking just up there somewhere that there's a mother and father and a sister and brother going about their life, whatever it is, and there's their son or whatever, his life's playing in a way, you know. Compassion or whatever. In the wee hours, is the interval got less and less, and the volume got less and less as he just faded away. Nothing that could do for him, nothing at all. But I think the following morning, we were still there, and the German Red Cross crews were around looking for casualties or whatever. You were actually whistling to point to where the lad was laying, and they came over to him, but nothing they could do. He'd gone there.
Any more? So you were in position. Any? What happened next there?
I can't remember anything more that happened along there, other than just firing at your trucks. And it was. I think our primary object there was to sort of stop stuff getting out. Which we did at that point in time. But,
what's the next thing you remember then?
Vague, yeah, very vague.
It's quite a complicated period. It's quite a lot of sort of fighting during the advance before the sort of big breakout in the advance to Amiens. It doesn't matter. I mean, what was the general nature of fighting in that time then?
It tended to be, rather than in this throwing yourself at a solid wall, you had more room to manoeuvre, the word could be easier, but you started operating probably more as the tank should be used, if that's the right expression. But you had more freedom of movement, perhaps, to move around these things. So you were travelling further and moving about a lot easier than it was prior. That's probably what I remember. But the officer that I had
was it still A Squadron 3 Troop?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, what was he like? Just from tracking.
Young lieutenant, very keen. Yeah, quite nice. You know, I mean, it's fairly easy going. He was good in the crew, quite good. He had to muck in and do his little bit, same as all the others, you know. I mean, I think, of course, Pinky Hutchinson had taken over the squadron at that point. We had several new officers, I'm sure. But this one, yeah, he had to muck in with the others, you know, refuel, reload.
What was Powell like? What was Hutchinson like? What were they like as officers? Did you know them much?
Not a great deal. You don't have a lot to do with them, you know. I mean, you would if you were in their crew, I guess. You do get to know them better. But squadron leader is a squadron leader, you know. I mean, it's you too much to do with people like that. To be honest, you hear his voice, and when he's called, you jump, you know.
Were there any officers that stood out in the whole regiment that, you know, that people would sort of look up to?
I suppose Osteen was the one that people would look up to more. He always seemed to be in the thick of it. I guess he was quite outstanding in some ways. But no, I don't think you didn't judge them, if you know what I mean. You were more concerned with your own little crowd.
What was the terrain like? You know, so was it bocage stuff or
the bocage country is these high hedges, high mound, and then the ditch on top. And
was that what you were getting?
We were running into that now more of it, bocage. It was difficult to punch through, but we certainly had more room to manoeuvre and get about. Somewhere along there, I can remember the we linked up an infantry attacking through the Bacard country, and I don't think it was our Mons or Hereford's for some strange reason, but one of them asked us to come up and fire down what looked to be a hole by the side of the ditch. So we rained a shell down there, high explosive, and we asked him why, and he said that they disappeared down the hole. These Germans, the infantry, had disappeared. And he went looting around there, and he found that there's a hole, and under, that's where he wanted the shot to go down. But coming the other side was another hole, and they dug under the hedge, across, into a tunnel under the hedge, into the next field. So these people would run back, dive down a hole, and go into the next field. That's why they were disappearing, evidently. But they also had, I went down there, and these things were beautiful, well cut. I suppose they'd use the labour force to do it, but they had benches down there. You could go down there, dive down a hole, and sit there. And also, they had a hole that they put a periscope up to see what was coming. So that was more effective for the infantry than us, but this is why you couldn't make out why these people were disappearing. A bit miffed. And I remember him quite well. He was bandaged up, he'd been wounded. He got the old pill bandages on him, his arm and his head. But he still kept going. He's one of these that was difficult to stop, I should think. I'm glad, isn't he? Beyond that, very little now. It was just more or less skirmishes. Nothing major, I don't think, that we got involved in. Nothing that come to mind. I was probably numbed by that.
Was your tank hit ever during this period?
Not to my knowledge, no. No.
And what's the next? I mean, there's the fighting, a lot of fighting around Bursey. Do you remember any of that?
It's strange that these names come up now, although your commander's got maps, they're usually localised little maps, so they don't have place names, only any numbers and all that. So place names really didn't mean over much to me that time. At one time along there, we were up against paratroops. There were paratroops involved, German paratroops involved. And we parked up quietly at one time on just a watching brief. And believe it or not, one of these paratroopers had actually put himself in view, and as we and sat absolutely still watching it, he actually knelt and still looking at us, and he was only by the hedge of 100 yards in front, and we still sat, and he stood up. He actually stood up, defiant, as it were. And as soon as they moved the turret, as soon to bring the turret around, he dived through the hedge. And he threw one of these little egg grenades. They used to carry little egg grenades that made a big bang. But, I mean, the sheer source of it, you have to admire his pluck, you know. Whether he thought you were knocked out or not, I don't know. But he actually stood up and he looked at me, and I was looking right in his face. And I thought, you were something embarrassing. Yeah. We fired a burst over the hedge, but I mean, he'd scuttled off. But I can remember that very clearly.
Any other little incidents? I know you can't put places to them.
There was an infantry attack. Well, they came forward towards us. This German infantry, and it was very rare. Up to then, we hadn't seen a lot of them. But they come charging down, and they got roped. This is where I think we burnt out the machine gun barrel, you know, just sort of firing it, they came down so far, and then when we started open fire, they turned around and started running. Well,
did you use both the Browning and the gun, or just the...
I just used the Browning, yeah, they were that close. And that was when we burnt the barrel of it out, that was changing.
And you mentioned how you changed it.
You mentioned you changed that from inside, but... you felt that when we got to that stage that you were beginning to crack the nut, as it were, a little bit. There weren't so many. What tanks there were, they could call up the Air Force, and they were dealing with a lot of them. It was about, must have been there that we crossed the village, and as we went across the road, the vehicle alongside us was hit, and we found afterwards that the shot, we couldn't see where the shot came from, but the German tank had actually gone in to the back of a garage, like a big double garage. He planted himself in there, and he was able then to sight straight down this little road, this lane that we crossed, or tried to cross to get down the village, and he hit this one. The time we tumbled it, somebody reported the tank backing out the back of the house, moving along the back of the village, and that was dealt with by the Air Force. These Typhoons and that made enormous difference out there. They could bang out the Tigers, no trouble.
Did you have a healthy respect for the Tiger as a Sherman tank?
Not much. Yes, it was. I think it weighed about 55 tons, something like that. It was. I understood. Because I actually looked over one at one time, and it was all power, all hydraulics. There were enormous hydraulics involved in it. I think it had power steering. I think the gunner had a footplate that if you put your foot down, if you tilt your foot one way, the turret would go one way. And the harder you pushed it down, the faster it went round. I could get, evidently, so I gathered afterwards, very fine control of it. I also understood that a pre-war German gunner had a sight made to his eyes to see him. And if he transferred from one thing to another, that sight went with him. What truth is in that, I know not, but it did sound right, I must admit.
Were you scared of tigers? I mean, you know, I mean, or panthers, whatever.
You knew that you were so vulnerable. To get at them, your normal range to get at them was something like 600 yards, and they could be playing havoc with you at 1,500 yards. You've got an awful lot of ground to cover somehow to get at them. If you could get round the back of them and bang one up the engine doors, then fair enough. But to get round there, you've got a hell of a distance. So we used to try and bottle them, occupy them, as somebody got round the back, or then somebody would pull the aircraft over. But yeah, healthy respect, they were. Yeah, they did command a healthy respect.
Sure. And what about the Sherman's reputation for burning? Had that got through to you now?
Yeah, not much. I suppose if you got the impression in the early stages, it caught fire fairly easy. But after Goodwood, I don't think there's anybody left in any doubt at all that these things were very vulnerable to it. They go up like that. It was obviously known before, because prior to going over, they worked on these side plates and the like, which made not a scrap of difference to my knowledge. Not a scrap. Mechanically, they were good. The gun was pretty useless, the 75, really. And the only one that really did count was the 17 pounder. That was good. But that again used to be searched out because the Germans knew these capabilities, I suppose, and would try and search it out. But the ordinary 75mm, 600 yards was about, to my knowledge, that was about the best you could manage. Which is pretty hairy, really. You've got 600 yards to cover to sort of get near.
Did you have nicknames for the Sherman?
Really, only Johnson, of course.
Which was?
Johnson, it's the old advert, is one flick and it lights, you know.
Did it make you nervous? I mean, did you practice getting out of the thing? Or think, you know?
No, I think you didn't need to practice that if when the time came, the commander was blocking the hatch anyway. With him there, so he had to go. The gunner then had to sort of pull himself out the seat and go out the hatch, and then you've got the loader operator. It was the other side of the breech. Now he couldn't get round that. He had to come under it, and then come up. So if there was an evacuation, he had to go in that order, where the driver and co-driver both had their own hatches to bail over. You always had the feeling that if the shot came from the left, you bailed to the right to try and put the vehicle between you and the gun or whatever. And that why I remember that crossing the road just recently, where this tank of fire straight down from this back of the house or through the house, was that I saw them bailing out. And one of them went the wrong way, and he caught the next shot. And he was a new lad. He'd only just recently joined us. So, if you like experience, it tends to sort of show a little bit. You do learn some of these things the hard way, but there is a learning curve to it.
But you didn't practice. It was just, you just knew what to do.
Yeah, you do it, yeah.
And how long would it take to get out of it?
A friend of mine, I think he was a gunner, and when he was hit, he was on the ground before the commander. Now, there was only a slight lad, this chap, but he managed to... and he couldn't tell you how he did it, but he was on the ground when the commander came down. Being hit, so as small as he was, he came through a very small place in the end, one hell of a hurry.